Hello, I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch, and it's time for our birthdays. Happy birthday to Charlotte Scott of Des Moines. If today is your birthday and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Let's get back to the news with our first story from the USA Today. Will Carlos, writing for the USA Today, one man's journey in the world of Proud Boys. They joined for brotherhood. They found a den of racism. Daniel Berry said he was searching for camaraderie. The 40-year-old Army veteran yearned to forge the sort of bonds that he had in the military, a brotherhood of like-minded men watching one another's backs, holding one another up, united in a common goal. Last year, Berry said he remembered a guy at the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall asking him if he had heard of the Proud Boys. The group was vocal in its support of President Donald Trump, whom Berry had voted for. Members called themselves Western chauvinists and said they welcomed true men. That sounded about right for Berry, who considered himself a dyed-in-the-wool patriot. He did some internet searches and sent off an email. Almost immediately, he received a link to an encrypted chat room. So began Berry's journey into the dark world of the Wisconsin chapter of the Proud Boys. Berry, along with a member of the Wisconsin Proud Boys and another former recruit, told USA Today the group is a den of racism and anti-Semitism. Moving up within the group, they said, is dependent on sadistically bullying potential members and promoting white supremacist talking points. Berry and two other men, who asked not to be named because they fear violent repercussions from members of the Proud Boys, spoke and emailed with USA Today independently, providing screenshots of chat rooms, photos, memes, and audio recordings that backed up their claims. Their accounts reveal the face of a group that masks itself as harmless, multiracial drinking club, one that reaches new members by preaching free speech and patriotism. At least in Wisconsin, the men said, the Proud Boys stand less for brotherhood and more for the racial hatred espoused by the Ku Klux Klan and Aryan nations. Initially, it was truly a brotherhood, Berry said, but what I experienced was more like a cult. The Proud Boys espoused a vague political ideology of unfettered free speech and nationalism expressed through offensive language, controversial memes, and shocking imagery. In 2018, the FBI categorized the Proud Boys as an extremist group with ties to white nationalism. The Southern Poverty Law Center estimates the group has 43 chapters in 29 states. Proud Boys leaders, such as National Chairman Henry Tarrio, who goes by Enrique and self-identifies as Afro-Cuban, insist it's not a white supremacist group. They point to non-white members as evidence. We're a little rough around the edges, but we're definitely not what they make us out to be, Tarrio told Business Insider last year. At least 25 people associated with the Proud Boys are among the more than 400 arrested in connection with the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Proud Boys have been charged with felonies stemming from their street fights, often with anti-fascist or Antifa protesters. I wouldn't call them terrorists. They're street fighters, said Daryl Johnson, a security consultant and former senior analyst for domestic terrorism at the Department of Homeland Security. He said law enforcement and the public should be wary of the Proud Boys, which saw a huge influx in members in 2019 and 2020. The group is increasingly likely to be an incubator for extremists who could graduate from street brawls to more serious violence, Johnson said. They're one of these environments where people get immersed and indoctrinated, he said. They're not one of these groups that's going to stand back holding signs. They're looking for a fight, and they could serve as a radicalization facilitator, becoming a Proud Boy. Berry and the other two men described their first contact with Wisconsin Proud Boys identically. Each said he received a link to join a private group on the encrypted messaging service Telegram. Berry and the other recruit, both white, middle-aged conservatives, said they hoped the chat room would be a place to discuss issues such as border security and gun rights. Berry said he was looking for somewhere he could be himself, a safe space to discuss conservative and libertarian politics outside the confines of his home, where his views often clashed with those of his left-leaning wife. None of the prospective members of the trusted news media, which they said falsely painted the Proud Boys as extremists and white supremacists. Barry said new media portrayals of the group reminded him of his experience in college, where professors and fellow students scorned him for being in the military. Participants in the chat room didn't use their real names, but upon joining, applicants were required to send Proud Boy leaders a copy of their state-issued ID cards. This was so leadership could check for their criminal records, but the men who spoke with USA Today noted it gave the group power over them. That chat room, all three men said, is fairly mild. Senior members dropped in, they said, to encourage recruits to attend a vetting meet, usually at a rural Wisconsin bar. 30 to 50 Proud Boys and pledges showed up at these events, urged in advance not to wear the group's signature black and gold colors. Barry and the other men said each applicant was called to a table where he was grilled by leaders of the Proud Boys as to why he wanted to join. Barry and the other men who spoke with USA Today made it past this stage. They were given a link to a second Telegram chat room. That's where, they said, things got nasty. The second chat room was swamped with every type of shocking content imaginable, the men said, and participants posted photos and videos of people getting killed and seriously injured. Users swapped the most explicit pornography they could find. Images flowed in a septic tide of racist, anti-Semitic, and homophobic banter. One of the men who spoke with USA Today described the content, videos of Muslims being set on fire or blown up? Check. Memes intended to laugh at Holocaust-era Jews? Check. Pictures of women being raped? Check. Memes poking fun at raped women? Check. I could go on, but you get the point. The images and memes, examples of which were shared with USA Today, didn't drive away Barry or the other two men. They said they've heard plenty of racist and homophobic comments in their mostly white communities. Barry said the chapter president had told him the chat room would be rough, like a hazing ritual. Only those with the toughest skin, who weren't offended by anything, would survive, he said. Barry said he believed it all played into the ethos of the Proud Boys as a group of tough guys fighting for free speech and independence. Proud Boy recruits in Wisconsin not only had to run the gauntlet of the chat room, he said, but they had to participate if they wanted to advance. Anyone who expressed discomfort with the conversation was viciously ridiculed. As he and other Proud Boy recruits attended more meetings, they said, they found that many men embraced the racism and anti-Semitism behind the jokes. Despite the Proud Boys' claims of being open to all ethnicities, the Wisconsin chapter is overwhelmingly white, Barry and the other men said. Barry remembered just one man who wasn't white at Proud Boy gatherings. He said the ethos of the group was clear. Get on board with racism or leave. It was clear to Barry and the two others that the only way to rise through the ranks to become an official Proud Boy was to signal allegiance to anti-Semitism and white supremacy. The ones that were definitely racist at meets, when we talked with them, it was patently obvious that they were racist. They moved up, Barry said. The recruiting process, the men described, is similar to ones used by white supremacist organizations, said Amarnath Amarsingham, assistant professor at the School of Religion of Queen's University in Ontario, Canada, who researches radicalization. Amarsingham said the Proud Boys cloaked its ideology to draw in recruits and then reveals its racist side once members are reeled in. They've been confusing researchers and academics for years, Amarsingham said. I wouldn't fault a random person who thought, based on their public rhetoric, based on the diversity of the group, that they're not actually white supremacists. Last week, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced a national strategy for countering domestic terrorism that focuses on homegrown extremist groups. Though it doesn't mention the Proud Boys, the strategy says the recruitment of impressionable young men into hate groups via the internet is a major and growing threat to the public. Proud Boys membership rituals. As Barry and others learned, the expectation to engage in racist, hateful banter served another purpose within the Proud Boys Telegram chat room. The recruits were told that they would be kicked out if they took screenshots of the chat rooms. Barry and the others said they learned that the group's leaders stored screenshots and videos that they could use against the men. Barry said he stuck it out in the chat room for weeks. He acknowledged that he engaged in racist and homophobic conversations, figuring they would eventually subside to reveal the brotherhood that he had been searching for. It didn't. 30 days in, Barry, like other Proud Boy applicants, was required to record a video reciting one of the group's credos. I, Daniel Barry, am a proud Western chauvinist who refuses to apologize for creating the modern world. The video, which USA Today viewed, was the last step in becoming a first-degree Proud Boy, Barry said. He waited for an invitation to be beaten into the group, a ritual in which a circle of Proud Boys repeatedly punches a first degree while he recites the names of five breakfast cereals. Anyone who makes it through is a second degree. The highest level, fourth degree, is reserved for members who get into a fight with a member of Antifa. It's a big joke, but the last couple, apparently, from what I understand, and definitely the one that I attended, have been more abusive, Barry said. It's not been, hey, let's punch this guy because he's a brother. It's been, hey, let's beat the crap out of this guy. Barry never made it that far. The atmosphere inside the vetting chat room grew more alarming, Barry said, including sadistic bullying that ended up with a prospective Proud Boy in a hospital. All three men interviewed for the story recalled with disgust the treatment of one recruit. The man, known by the nickname Tony Gavin, became the Wisconsin Proud Boys' whipping boy, Barry and the other men said. For weeks, they said, senior members bullied the man incessantly, questioning his sexuality and mocking the fact that his wife has a disability. The abuse was delivered by text, memes, and videos posted to Telegram. The bullying got so bad that Tony was admitted to a hospital with a heart problem, Barry said. They led him into that chat to make sure that everyone would gang up on him and see if the group coalesced around being a bully to this guy, Barry said. Once the entertainment part was gone, they kicked him out of the group and they continued to terrorize him until he went into the hospital. Around the same time, another Proud Boy posted a meme to the chat room mocking rape victims. It wasn't the first, but it was particularly extreme. Barry decided he'd had enough. Far from the camaraderie he had come for, Barry said, he had found racism, sadism, and bullying. Like, where is your humanity? Where is your soul? He said, this is definitely a fake brotherhood. Tario said the Proud Boys has always been open to non-whites and people of every religion except Islam, and gay men are welcome. Over text messages and on his Telegram channel, Tario claimed the men interviewed by USA Today are not really Proud Boys and do not represent his group. He declined to be interviewed for the story. So did the president of the Wisconsin chapter of the Proud Boys, who goes by Debo the Viking. None of the men interviewed knows his real name. Proud Boys founder Gavin McGinnis, who said he cut ties with the group, claimed that anybody espousing racism or homophobia isn't a true Proud Boy. McGinnis declined to answer questions in a brief call. In an email, he claimed that the accusations of the men who spoke with USA Today were false, and reporting them would make the group more likely to be a haven for racists. When you spotlight some dumb rumor about the club going full white nationalist, a much more sinister option arrives. Blacks and gays and Jews, etc. go, I guess this club isn't for me, and leave, he wrote. Subsequently, bona fide white nationalists then become attached to it. In other words, you are creating hate where it wasn't previously. The men who spoke with USA Today don't know whether the Wisconsin chapter reflects the movement as a whole, but they warned that what happened could be a harbinger of widespread problems. We are letting in and promoting way too many men who embodied the very worst of this country, a Proud Boy wrote in an email. As the ranks of the racist members increase, the likelihood of promoting those who agree with that disgusting behavior is also increased. Samantha Kuttner, who founded Intuitive Threat Assessment, an agency specializing in intelligence on violent extremism, said the Wisconsin chapter doesn't appear to be an aberration. Kuttner, who has interviewed more than 20 current and former Proud Boys, said the organization has left behind any notions of egalitarianism or diversity. It's true that for some Proud Boys, involvement might be just meeting up once a month with the boys and drinking and complaining about the wife and then going home, Kuttner said. But when you look at the group as a whole and its aims, they are a violent, crypto-fascist, extremist organization. The group's structure and recruitment process push members further into the world of extremism, she said. As a function of the degree system, you can become significantly more radicalized by the sheer exposure to the anti-trans, misogynistic, homophobic, and anti-Semitic content, Kuttner said. Their whole joke is blurring the line between satire, human edge, and reality, she said. I don't think a lot of them know where the line is, but they get pulled closer to it as a function of being in the group. Since the Capitol insurrection of January 6th, there have been signs the Proud Boys is fragmenting. After a leadership battle last year, a faction split off to create an explicitly white supremacist group that calls itself the Proud Goys, speaking out under threat. Since contacting USA Today, Barry has been publicly disavowed by the people who had invited him to become a brother. In late May, a blurred copy of his driver's license was posted on the Wisconsin Proud Boys public Telegram channel. It was accompanied by a message posted by Debo and threatened to share videos Barry had posted. Barry said he heard from someone inside the Wisconsin Proud Boys that his life has been threatened. He stopped leaving the house when his wife is home. He sleeps during the day and keeps a vigil at night, walking the perimeter of his property and relying on his guard dog to warn him of intruders. Barry said he has no one to blame for this predicament but himself. Against his better judgment, he said he trusted the Proud Boys' propaganda and listened to conservative pundits who praised the group. After more than 5 months, Barry said he quit. He said he's appalled that he ever got involved with the Proud Boys. I was in the wrong, not just in joining the group, but the things that I did. He said, I did this to myself, and I'm not the good guy here. Daryl Lamont Jenkins, who has tracked extremists since the 1980s, said the origin story of the Proud Boys, that they're a drinking club that got out of hand and became political, sounds familiar. At the outset, Jenkins said the Ku Klux Klan were basically just old Confederate soldiers who needed to blow off steam. Before long, Jenkins said, the Klan became a terror group that intimidated, attacked, and killed Black people. It's the same exact origin story. Maureen Grope, writing for the USA Today, Biden's chances to update FDR are getting slimmer. Idea of big government still makes some wary. The descendants of the men and women who designed and implemented President Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal gather regularly on Zoom to strategize how to keep the pressure on President Joe Biden to likewise go big and bold. We would love to think that we have captured his attention and stirred the pot for some FDR seasoning, said Scott Wallace, the grandson of one of Roosevelt's vice presidents and one of five descendants who have been urging Biden for the past year to pass a 21st century New Deal. There's a new bargain, Biden said in May during a trip to Cleveland to push for the trillions of dollars he wants to spend on infrastructure, education, healthcare, childcare, and more. Everyone is going to be in on the deal this time. Many comparisons, not all of them favorable, have been made between the size and scope of Biden's ambitions and Roosevelt's programs and the World War II spending that lifted the nation out of the Great Depression. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, at the forefront of selling the infrastructure component of Biden's plan, calls it the largest job package since World War II. Today's effort might be described as the big deal, Buttigieg said in May in a speech to graduates at the Harvard Kennedy School. The big deal is based on a big ambition to demonstrate how good government can indeed do big and good things and do them well. Biden's plan to give all Americans access to affordable high-speed internet evokes the New Deal initiative to bring electricity to rural America. Updating Roosevelt's Civilian Conservation Corps that put millions of men to work on conservation and development projects on rural lands, Biden wants to create a Civilian Climate Corps to address the threat of climate change. Just as labor unions were boosted by the National Labor Relations Act of 1935 that sanctioned the right to bargain collectively, Biden has emphasized the importance of unions, including calling on Congress to strengthen protections for workers' rights to organize. Roosevelt had an arsenal of democracy to sell military supplies to Great Britain and France. Biden has declared that the United States will be the world's arsenal of vaccines in the shared fight against the coronavirus. At the start of Biden's first foreign trip this month, he and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson released a revitalized Atlantic Charter, updating the 1941 attempt by Roosevelt and Prime Minister Winston Churchill to rally the West at a time of global crisis. And don't forget about the massive portrait of FDR that hangs across from his desk over the Oval Office fireplace. Time is running out. After swift passage of a $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package in March, Biden's hope of making generational and transformational changes is running up against a closely divided Congress and the clock. Time is running out, said Stephen Wayne, who is writing a book on Biden's presidency. He will not end up getting as much done as he wants to get done. Presidents typically achieve their biggest accomplishments early in their first terms. Democrats have no room for error in the 50-50 Senate, and Senator Joe Manchin, a moderate Democrat from West Virginia, has resisted moving forward without support from Republicans. A bipartisan group of senators is working on a smaller version of Biden's proposed spending on public works such as roads, bridges, and broadband. Liberals, who have been pleasantly surprised by the scope of Biden's plans, don't want to cede ground. In fact, some Senate Democrats are trying to raise the price tag. What we're working right now is on a budget that builds on the proposals that the president has brought to us, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said Thursday. Democrats know they could lose control of the House next year unless Biden defies history. Since the 1930s, the president's party has lost House seats in every midterm election during the president's first term, with two exceptions: the 2002 midterms during George W. Bush's second year after the 2001 terrorist attacks, and the 1934 midterms during Roosevelt's first term. FDR gained seats in Congress, said his grandson, James Roosevelt Jr. People saw what he was doing to restore the health of the country, both physically and financially. Biden has described the moment as a test of government, not just to show it can deliver for people, but also that democracy works and performs better than autocracies. I think this generation is going to be marked by the competition between democracies and autocracies because the world is changing so rapidly, Biden said when releasing his American Jobs Plan in April. The autocrats are betting on democracy not being able to generate the kind of unity needed to make decisions to get in that race. We can't afford to prove them right. We have to show the world, and much more importantly, we have to show ourselves that democracy works. Though the updated Atlantic Charter may burnish Biden's claim to Roosevelt's economic legacy, a lot has changed since FDR, according to Stuart Patrick at the Council of Foreign Relations. The two most important relevant differences may be the diminished position of the United States and the internal political divisions that beset America today, Patrick wrote in an analysis for World Politics Review. As Biden aims to put pressure on a disruptive Russia and an economically ascendant China, Democrats have sounded the alarm about the Capitol insurrection January 6th, former President Donald Trump's false claims of a stolen election, and laws passed in Republican-led states placing restrictions on voting rules. When Roosevelt was elected, totalitarian states were on the rise. He faced pressure from within the United States for a benevolent autocracy to wield power sufficient to deal with the nation's immense problems. Joe Biden read up on FDR. That tussle was the first thing Biden mentioned when recounting in October how he was rereading The Defining Moment, Jonathan Altier's book about FDR's first 100 days. There's no such thing as a guaranteed democracy, Biden said in a podcast interview with author Brené Brown. It has to be fought for every time. If you read just the first chapter, talk about how guys like Walter Lippmann were telling Roosevelt, we have to have a dictatorship to get it right. There's nothing automatic about this. Central to that argument is Biden's ability to get the economy back on track, not just to recover from the pandemic, but to deepen federal investments in the workforce, families, infrastructure, research and development, and the environment. We're in the midst of a fourth industrial revolution of enormous consequence, Biden said at his first full news conference in March. Will there be a middle class? How will people adjust to these significant changes in science and technology and the environment? How will they do that? And are democracies equipped because all the people get to speak, to compete? Biden said his long Senate career has defined more by his foreign policy expertise than work on types of domestic spending he is championing as president. They'd always announced me in the past as an expert in foreign policy, he said in his Cleveland speech. Well, let me tell you something. Economic policy is harder than foreign policy. You know what the basic of foreign policy is in our stature in the world? One thing, our economic prowess. As a sign that the nation's approach, which has focused on getting Americans vaccinated along with the coronavirus relief package, is working, Biden touts the fact that the U.S. economy is growing faster than any other major economy. Biden's proposals aren't as big a share of the economy as Roosevelt's, but they're more comparable when combined with coronavirus relief passed during Trump's administration, according to one calculation. The cost of Roosevelt's New Deal was roughly 40% the size of the national economy in 1929, estimated Bill Dupore, an economist and assistant vice president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. The $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package, combined with about $4.1 trillion in additional spending Biden initially proposed, which may get scaled back, is about 28% as large as the economy was in 2019, before the pandemic hit. But when combined with the $3.3 trillion in coronavirus relief spending that passed in the last year of the Trump administration, the total cost would be 43% as large as the 2019 economy if fully enacted. June Hopkins, the granddaughter of Roosevelt's Commerce Secretary, sees similarities between Biden's assessment of democracy and FDR's. The idea that democracy is at risk now is the same fear that Roosevelt had of democracy being at risk because of the Depression, she said. Fascism was growing in Europe and in Japan. The collapse of the economy created public unrest in the USA. There were pushes from the left, as well as the later rise of the America First Committee, to keep the nation from entering World War II. While dealing with those problems during the 1930s, Roosevelt kept his attention on the economy, Hopkins said. He knew that if America would fail economically, it would also fail politically, she said. Reversing Ronald Reagan, the huge expansion of government under Roosevelt got another boost from the Great Society programs under President Lyndon Johnson, before President Ronald Reagan declared during his 1981 inaugural address, government is not the solution to our problem, government is the problem. Biden, it seems to me, is trying to put a minus sign in front of that proposition, Bill Galston, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, said in April during a discussion at the think tank about Biden's first 100 days. And everything that he does is unified by the proposition that in the circumstances we now face, government is the solution and not a problem. Reagan's view predominated even through the administration of Democratic President Bill Clinton, in which Galston was a domestic policy advisor. Clinton declared in his 1996 State of the Union address that the era of big government is over. President Barack Obama, whom Biden served as vice president, faced bipartisan consensus that deficits are bad, Alter said. For 50 years, Dems have lacked a pres who could build on the New Deal, Alter retweeted in March, calling Biden FDR's first true heir since LBJ. Dan Pfeiffer, a former communication director for Obama, said the relative ease with which Biden passed the coronavirus relief legislation belied how difficult it will be for Biden to achieve the rest of his grand plans. Even I, a dyed-in-the-wool pessimist, got swept up in the FDR comparisons, Pfeiffer wrote in a newsletter published on Substack. Passing a relief bill in the middle of a pandemic was always going to be exponentially easier than holding together the Democratic coalition to pass multi-trillion-dollar structural changes to the economy and electoral system. Wayne said fiscal conservatives' arguments against Biden's plans are potent because the nation hasn't moved that far left. It's liberalized a little bit, said Wayne, a professor emeritus at Georgetown University, but we're still closer to the age of Reagan than we are to the domestic dimension of Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. Republican attacks. In May, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said in a speech to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that for decades, the prevailing focus has been on the need to decrease and limit the size of government as a share of the economy. This approach to U.S. fiscal policy, founded on a distrust of government motives and effectiveness, along with a resistance to higher taxes, has had profound effects on our nation and our people, she said. It is time to recommit our government to playing a more active and smarter role in the economy. When the administration released budget projections showing that under Biden's plans, the nation's debt would rise relative to the size of the economy to higher levels than during World War II, Republicans said it showed overreach by the administration. The best thing you can say about this budget is that it will never happen, said Texas Representative Kevin Brady, the top Republican on the House Tax Writing Committee. Former Vice President Mike Pence charged that after Biden campaigned as a moderate, he has governed as the most liberal president since FDR. A Pew Research Center poll shows public trust in government remains low. Those more likely to want the government to do more to solve problems, women, minorities, and younger people, are the foundation of the Democratic base. Under Roosevelt, that base included blue-collar workers, a bloc that has migrated to the GOP. Biden bets that his economic plans can win back some of those voters. The other side of the argument, and it's an ongoing argument among strategists in the Democratic Party, is that the essence of the working class opposition to Democrats and to the Biden presidency is less about economics than it is about culture and race, Galston said. If that's the case, then even if Biden is successful, his programs may not have the kind of political payoff that the Biden administration is hoping for, he said. Now let's turn to the opinion section from the Des Moines Register. Jonathan Wilson is our first year-term guest columnist, Improve Police Through Accreditation. For many years, I served as the chairperson of the appellate panel of NCATE, which at the time was the only national accreditation agency for teacher education colleges. I reflect on that experience as I observe turmoil over the performance of the nation's law enforcement agencies. With NCATE, which is now the Council for the Accreditation of Educator Preparation, a teacher education college had the right to appeal from adverse findings of an experienced team of examiners following a several-day on-site visit at the college. Such visits happened on a set schedule. The on-site inspectors could recommend suspension of full accreditation pending prompt satisfaction of stated requirements for improvement, or even recommend the complete withdrawal of accreditation. NCATE's members were the accredited colleges themselves, and their input determined the standards that were expected of teacher education institutions under accrediting standards. The examiners were professors and administrators of accredited colleges charged with measuring each college against those standards. If a teacher education college was disappointed with the examiner's accreditation recommendation, it could appeal to the panel that I chaired. To my frustration, the colleges of education at Drake University, the University of Northern Iowa, Iowa State University, and the University of Iowa were not nationally accredited. The standards were remarkably thorough and detailed. On a wide range of operational and curriculum matters, the standards represented what the accredited NCATE members themselves had determined to be best practices. Those best practices continually evolved over time, and teacher education colleges are kept apprised so they can make changes before the next site visit by NCATE examiners. Accreditation led to adoption and maintenance of the highest standards and improved performance. Accreditation is the longer-term answer to the need to reform and improve the performance of law enforcement agencies such as highway patrol, police departments, and sheriff's departments. Law enforcement accreditation is a special status that is accorded to the law enforcement agency by the Commission on the Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies, or CALEA. Accreditation in law enforcement is similar to accreditation of other fields, such as hospitals and colleges. About 3% of law enforcement agencies in the United States are currently accredited. Already, after an unfortunate incident involving law enforcement, think George Floyd and myriad other examples, there is an investigation by the Department of Justice or others, and the requirements are imposed for improvements of the specific circumstance and law enforcement response that created the incident. But those happen after the fact and tend to be incident specific. Accreditation is in an effort to make a meaningful reduction in the number of incidences before they would otherwise happen. Accreditation standards evolve over time as better policing practices are identified from knowledgeable expertise of those in the accredited agencies. Two facts make CALEA accreditation critically useful for reform improvement of law enforcement. One, law enforcement is unique among government services because of the potential for lethal force administered by people authorized to carry weapons and use those weapons to compel compliance with the law, often requiring split-second decisions on when and how much force to use. And two, most policy decision makers with oversight of law enforcement agencies, city council members, for example, lack significant law enforcement experience or expertise regarding best policing practices. Because of the need for good split-second decisions by law enforcement officers in situations that might arise, and the need for ongoing knowledgeable evaluation and oversight of policing practices, CALEA accreditation becomes critical. It is not a silver bullet, but in the longer term, the number of unfortunate law enforcement incidences can be reduced before they would otherwise happen. Maybe the Des Moines City Council would see fewer disruptive demonstrations if the Des Moines Area Police Department was told to gain and maintain CALEA accreditation. It would cost money to do both, but compare that to the cost of a human life, the cost of the loss of public confidence in our local law enforcement agency, and the cost of out-of-court settlements. Jonathan Wilson is an attorney practicing in Des Moines. And in letters to the editor today, our first letter comes from Mary McBee of Tama. Animal agriculture is killing this state. In Iowa, the number of animals packed into factory farms produce as much waste as 168 million people, or 53 times that of our state's population. 53 times! Manure waste is housed in giant lagoons that sometimes flood, and that, along with the applied nitrate runoff from the fields, caused Des Moines to build the largest municipal water treatment plant in the world just so city residents can drink water from their faucets. Guess who pays? This doesn't account for all the air pollution created by factory farms. It's now revealed that thousands of deaths are caused in areas located near factory farms in this country, even more than from coal pollution. However, doesn't the Environmental Protection Agency address these hazards? Not for Big Ag. During Donald Trump's administration, the EPA even exempted factory farms from reporting requirements regarding release of ammonias and other toxic emission as required of other industries. State agencies are little more effective under pressures from political leaders, and Big Ag responds to state regulatory queries with a claim of a clean bill of health from local authorities supporting Big Ag. Iowans don't need more factory farms. We need to get rid of a bunch that are already here. From Kurt Johnson of Urbandale, we should axe a couple of holidays. I propose that Congress eliminate both Washington's birthday and Columbus Day federal holidays. With the addition of Juneteenth, federal workers currently have 11 paid holidays. Most workers in the private sector don't get paid days off for Washington's birthday, President's Day, or Columbus Day. Federal workers also already have generous pay and other benefits, so it shouldn't be a problem eliminating those paid holidays. And Max D. Isaacson of West Des Moines writes, defending your home is criminal now. I'm shocked by the St. Louis decision that resulted in the ruling against the homeowners Patricia and Mark McCloskey. If you can't defend your own home from intruders, what can you defend? This asinine decision shows the depravity to which our justice has descended. Even the prosecutor has admitted that the McCloskeys called police, no shots were fired, and no one was hurt. The political cartoon today is drawn by Mike Thompson for USA Today, and it's titled, U.S. Could See Its Worst Drought in 1,200 Years. And then in the middle of the picture, which is kind of a rainy scene with some water on the ground, stands a man with a t-shirt that says Skeptics. And he says, I was wrong. Climate change is not a big hoax. It's a humongous hoax. Our second year-turn guest columnist, Shauna Rainey, writes Art Fest Midwest highlights Iowa's homegrown talent. My fellow Iowa artists and I are looking forward to returning to festivals, shows, and events this summer after a long and difficult year apart from our beloved arts community. Now, in its 18th year, Art Fest Midwest is well known for its support of homegrown talent. Almost one half of the artists showcasing their work at this year's event call Iowa home. More than 80% hail from the Midwest, cultivating a community of artists that are a reflection of the people we call friends, family, and neighbors. Held at the ends of Art Week on Saturday, June 26th and Sunday, June 27th, this show is unique in that Iowa artists showcase their work to an Iowa audience. Art Fest Midwest makes for a fun and family-friendly day. As a young girl, my mom helped instill in me a love of the arts, and we have truly enjoyed attending Art Fest Midwest since its inception. In fact, I bought my first piece of art at the show. It is a beautiful goddess pottery statue that has only 9 toes. The artist told me that she only puts 9 toes on our goddesses to remind us that even goddesses are not perfect. Those words have stuck with me and become my mantra. In 2014, with support from my family and friends, I opened Winged Goddess Studio. I chose the name in part to honor my late father, who is my guardian angel, and to pay tribute to my first piece of art. As a jewelry artist, I love creating and incorporating a variety of textures and styles into my work. Handmaking the pieces affords me the fun of trying new techniques and even turning a mistake into an aha moment. I believe in simple design, which allows the wearer to choose to wear the piece solo or layer with other jewelry pieces, so it gives me great pleasure to say thank you for being part of my journey. For me, an Iowa artist is truly an honor to participate in Art Fest Midwest. I admit, though, it is much more than selling my jewelry. It is creating relationships with customers and meeting my fellow artists, many of whom have become lifelong friends. It is also the dedication of the staff and volunteers whose hard work make this such an exciting event. It never fails that when I participate in Art Fest Midwest, I am in awe of the talent on display by painters, potters, photographers, metalsmiths, jewelry creators, and so many more art disciplines. I am thrilled that Art Fest Midwest is moving to Hy-Vee Hall at the Iowa Events Center this summer. The downtown location puts us artists close to the pulse of the metro. With the free shuttle service running from 12th Street and Walnut Streets every half hour, it is easier than ever to attend this year's event. More information about the festival and artists is at artfestmidwest.com. When sorting out your summer plans this year, make sure you don't miss Art Fest Midwest on June 26th and 27th. Come check out the best talent in the Midwest and stop by Winged Goddess Studio to say hello. Shauna Rainey of Boone, owner of Winged Goddess Studio, is an artist who sneaks time to create in between working full-time and being a mom and wife. Now we'll look at the opinion page of the USA Today. Today's debate, For the People Act. Our view, good ideas on voting rights and a very bad one. Joe Manchin has been right about voting rights reform, but then he's also been very, very wrong. The moderate Democratic senator from the deeply red state of West Virginia is spot on when he raises serious concerns about the bloated partisan legislation known as the For the People Act, passed by the House as H.R. 1 and up for a vote to advance in it in the Senate on Tuesday as S-1. Manchin sent shockwaves when he wrote in a June 6th op-ed that he would not vote for S-1, which would prevent it from passing under any circumstances, including a rule change allowing it to become law with a simple majority vote in the Senate. That bill, while containing some valuable tools for safeguarding the right to vote, is indeed filled with a Democratic wish list. And worse, Democratic sponsors have shown no interest in negotiating any of it away to attract Republicans. Manchin, who has a right-leaning constituency to placate, has also made clear that he would not vote for any rule change that would kill the filibuster. The filibuster is a Senate parliamentary procedure that stalls legislation through debate, effectively killing it, unless 60 senators vote to end debate. The senator has a point when he says the legislation could be dramatically pared down, and to his credit, He produced an outline last week of a reduced voter reform package that he would support. His proposal combines portions of S1 with elements of the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which Manchin said he supports and for which he says there is potentially bipartisan interest. The Lewis legislation is designed to restore and strengthen portions of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court struck down in 2013. Most important, it reestablishes the requirement that states' changes to election procedures receive clearance by the Justice Department Civil Rights Division to ensure that voting rights are not being infringed upon. Republican state legislatures across the country, using as a pretext of Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 election was stolen because of unsubstantiated voter fraud. The truth is, it was one of the most fair and free elections in recent history, have been proposing or have passed scores of bills that effectively suppress voting access. In addition, structural biases in the electoral system persist where legislatures, mostly Republican, can create serpentine, gerrymandering districts designed to benefit the majority party. Perhaps most troubling, legislatures have also passed laws allowing legitimate voting results to be more easily challenged and potentially overturned. The For the People Act addresses only a portion of these crucial concerns. It would establish nationwide standards for mail-in balloting, voter registration, early voting, and other access issues. And it would end gerrymandering. But S1 does nothing about new laws that allow state political leaders to throw out fair election results. Manchin's compromise included some pared-down elements of S1, a slightly weakened version of the Lewis legislation, and a few other proposals popular with conservatives. One is a sensible idea this page has long endorsed, requiring voters to show some form of identification. There should be a more bipartisan approach on an issue as vital as election reform. As Manchin says, it's right to vote. The right to vote is fundamental to our American democracy, and protecting that right should not be about party or politics. But this is where he's very, very wrong. He also writes that protecting this right, which is a value I share, should never be done in a partisan manner. Fair enough. But one day after Manchin released his compromise proposal, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell rejected it. What if a slimmed-down election reform package attracts only one or two Republican senators, falling far short of the 60 votes required to end a filibuster and pass the legislation? If that were to happen, it might be time for Manchin to consider some Senate rule changes, perhaps reducing the threshold for ending Senate debate after 55 votes instead of 60, or allowing a special exemption for momentarily lifting the filibuster rule, just for the election reform bill. Because the right to vote, as Manchin has eloquently said, is fundamental and demands to be safeguarded. The opposing view is written by Jeff Merkley, a U.S. Senator of Oregon. It's not about helping one political party. On January 6th, we were all reminded in the starkest of terms, the government of the people, by the people, and for the people is not guaranteed. But a violent mob unleashed on the U.S. Capitol is not the only way to attack a democracy. In fact, our We the People democracy has been under siege for decades as the powerful and privileged have funneled billions in dark money into elections and undermined American citizens' right to vote. Why? So the government does their bidding instead of reflecting the will of the people. The For the People Act would do some popular common sense things to put the people back in charge. First, it sets some national standards so every citizen has the freedom, the equal freedom to vote, no matter where they live. Second, it stops billionaires and corporations from buying elections. Third, it ends partisan gerrymandering so politicians don't get to pick their voters anymore. And finally, it stops conflict of interest corruption, so government officials work for us, not themselves. None of these are about helping one political party or another, and in fact, they're wildly popular among people of all political bents. When voters read the description of the bill, 96% of Democrats and 75% of Republicans support it. Similar numbers support various specific provisions. The people who don't like this bill are the powerful special interests and some politicians who do their bidding. Their agenda of ensuring billionaires and corporations pay virtually no taxes, enabling pollution, opposing minimum wage and paid leave, and cutting funding for education, childcare, and healthcare is deeply unpopular, especially among a younger, more diverse electorate. Unable to win on their ideas, they are resorting instead to an increasingly desperate effort to hold or seize power without winning free and fair elections. As revealed in an expose based on a leaked conference call, they know their only hope to hang on to power is to mislead people about what the For the People Act is and does. Don't believe the misinformation. The American people deserve the government promised to them by the Constitution of, by, and for the people. The interlocking pieces of the For the People Act work together to do the most important thing in a democracy, ensure that the government works for the people. None of us should be ready to compromise on that vision. Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat from Oregon, is the lead sponsor of S1, the For the People Act. Our last opinion piece is written by Dusko Doder, a retired journalist. I wasn't killed for my reporting, but I spent years in legal defense. When President Joe Biden's Justice Department said it would no longer seize journalist records to try to uncover their sources, I had an extra reason to cheer. After more than three decades ago, as a Washington Post reporter who dedicated my life to the practice and values of American journalism, I suffered deliberate governmental revenge for my reporting from Moscow. My cautionary tale demonstrated how, even in the United States, journalists can be punished for doing their jobs and why U.S. press freedoms need defending. The Biden Justice Department decision followed revelations that the Trump administration had sought email logs from four New York Times reporters and records from journalists at CNN, The Washington Post, and other news organizations. Attacks on journalists know no party lines. The investigation continued under Biden, and the Obama administration also aggressively sought reporters' records to uncover leakers. U.S. Press Freedom Tracker counted press freedom violations across 36 states and more than 80 cities in the past year, with an average of 1.6 assaults per day on journalists, mostly by law enforcement. America's founders believed that a free press is central to holding governments accountable. Thomas Jefferson said, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without government, I would not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." Scooping U.S. intelligence. That quote helped inspire me to escape from communist Yugoslavia and dedicate my life to the truth-telling journalism I believed was only possible in the United States. But my aggressive reporting from Moscow won me enemies, in part because it was often proved more accurate than U.S. intelligence assessments. My troubles began on a frigid Moscow night in February of 1984, when, as the Washington Post's Moscow bureau chief, I uncovered signs that Soviet leader Yuri Andropov had died. The CIA scoffed that I must be smoking pot, but I was correct. The Post and other world media ran stories wondering how the multi-billion dollar U.S. spy agencies had missed the signs picked up by a lone reporter. The first effort at Cold War-style revenge against me came more than 2 years later in 1986, when then-CIA Director William Casey and then-FBI Director William Webster attempted to force the Post editor, Ben Bradley, to remove me from the intelligence beat he had assigned me to. Bradley refused. The next effort, 6 years later, after I had left the Post, was in the shape of a misleading story insinuated into Time magazine by sources later revealed to be linked to U.S. intelligence, suggesting that I had been co-opted by the KGB. Bradley and the Post editors fought but failed to prevent the smear. A who's who of American journalists who had reported from the communist world wrote a letter of protest to Time, and I sued Time in court. Eventually, I won damages and an apology and exposed the details and sources of the smear. But the personal cost was incalculable. "You sure got some friends at Langley, pal," was how Bradley put it to me, referencing the location of the CIA headquarters in North Virginia. Reputation assassination. I am thankful to be living in peaceful retirement. I can be thankful that I was not murdered in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Turkey, as was journalist Jamal Khashoggi. I can be thankful that I was not imprisoned after being removed from a commercial airliner forced down by government fighter jets, as happened to Belarusian reporter Roman Protasevich recently. I can also be thankful that I was not killed like 50 journalists worldwide in 2020, according to Reporters Without Borders. Largely because of U.S. laws and protections, the attacks on me were covert, an attempt at reputation assassination rather than real assassination. Nevertheless, the price I paid was steep, including years of lonely litigation to clear my name. Presidents and officials throughout U.S. history have resented journalists exposing what they did not want made public. America's press freedoms that helped them hold them accountable are now eroding. The Justice Department decision is to be applauded, as are Biden's words, with which Jefferson would have agreed, that the seizing of reporters' communications was simply wrong. Dusko Doder, a former Washington Post correspondent, is author, and Louise Branson of the forthcoming memoir, The Inconvenient Journalist. Branson is a former USA Today editorial writer. We have one more short USA Today article written by Mabinti Karshi. Report: Biden to unveil Obama's official portraits. President Joe Biden is bringing back presidential portrait unveilings. Biden will host a White House ceremony later this year to unveil former President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama's official portraits, according to an NBC News report. The Obamas' portraits were virtually done, a person familiar with the process told U.S. NBC News. Former President Donald Trump famously did not participate in a White House unveiling of Obama's portrait while in office. He was not expected to participate in a White House ceremony with Biden either. Trump is working on his official portrait, though, according to NBC News. Barack Obama's office would not confirm the report to USA Today. The National Portrait Gallery unveiled portraits of the Obamas in 2018. The gallery portraits are part of the only complete collection of presidents outside the White House. The portrait of Barack Obama by artist Kendi Wiley and Michelle Obama's portrait by artist Amy Sherald are the first presidential portraits created by Black artists. It has been a decades-long tradition for first-term presidents to host their predecessor as a show of camaraderie in Washington. When Obama was in office, he hosted former President George W. Bush and former First Lady Laura Bush for their official portrait unveiling at the White House. Bush hosted former President Bill Clinton and former Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton for their official portraits. While in office, Trump replaced the portraits of Clinton and Bush with portraits of former Republican presidents Theodore Roosevelt and William McKinley. In March, Biden put the portraits of Clinton and Bush back on display. And that's it for our second hour of The Register on Iris. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.